Living entities born from wombs, from eggs, and from perspiration, as plants and trees that grow out of the earth, as all living entities, both moving and standing, including the demigods and learned sages and the Pitas, as outer space, as a higher planetary system containing the heavenly planets, and as the planet Earth with its hills, rivers, seas, oceans, and islands. Indeed, all the stars and planets are simply manifestations of your different energies, but originally, you are one without a second, therefore, there is nothing beyond you. This entire cosmic manifestation is therefore not false, but is simply a temporary manifestation of your inconceivable energy. Purport, this verse completely rejects the theory of Brahma Satyam Jagan Mithya, which states that spirit or Brahman is real, whereas the manifested material world, with its great variety of things, is false. Nothing is false. One thing may be permanent and another temporary, but both the permanent and the temporary are facts. For example, if someone becomes angry for a certain period, no one can say that his anger is false. It is simply temporary. Everything we experience in our daily lives is of the same character. It is temporary, but real. The different kinds of living entities coming from various sources are very clearly described in this verse. Some are born from a womb, and some, like certain insects, from human perspiration. Others hatch from eggs, and still others sprout from the earth. A living entity takes birth under different circumstances according to his past activities, karma. Although the body of the living entity is material, it is never false. No one will accept the argument that since a person's material body is false, murder has no repercussions. Our temporary bodies are given to us according to our karma, and we must remain in our given bodies to enjoy the pains and pleasures of life. Our bodies cannot be called false, they are only temporary. In other words, the energy of the Supreme Lord is as permanent as the Lord Himself, although His energy is sometimes manifest and sometimes not. As summarized in the Vedas, Sarvam Kalvidam Brahma, everything is Brahman. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. So the main point is that everything is Brahman. That's the last sentence of the purport, and that's the prayer that's being offered also. That everything is actually Brahman, and whatever we see before us is just a manifestation of Brahman. So there's no distinction. So we're called as non-dualist. They have this distinction in the material world, dualist, non-dualism. And sometimes devotees think that we're dualists because, I'm here and Krishna's there, therefore there's two of us, and therefore we're dualists. But actually, we're also non-dualists. It just depends on how you understand the term non-dual. We understand the term non-dual in terms of non-separateness as opposed to non-distinction. These are kind of like the two prominent ideas of non-dualism. One idea is non-separateness. There's no separateness from ourselves and God, and therefore it's non-dual. Or another idea that it's non-distinct. There's no distinction whatsoever. So the first idea is consistent with our experience and also with Shastra. The fact that that something can be non-separate but distinct. Is a reality, and it explains a lot. The example given is a fire. The potency of fire is non-separate from fire, and therefore it's a non-dual reality, and you can say it in that context. You can't have fire over here. Prabhupada gave this example in the previous purport. You can't have fire over here and the potency of fire over here. The two are always together, so they're a non-dual reality. When you think of one, you automatically think of the other, so it's a non-dual truth. At the same time, although it's one, or eka, it is one, there is distinction. So it's not one without distinction, it's one with distinction. Although fire and heat and light are one, they're distinct because you can describe the fire in terms of the potency. So there's a distinction between the potent and the potency. And so also this is our understanding of oneness or non-duality in the Krishna consciousness movement. That there's only Brahman, there isn't anything else, it's just Brahman. But in Brahman, there is potency or Shakti. Parasya Shakti Vividaiva Shriyate. The Vedas say like this, that the Brahman is containing Shakti. And that Shakti is one with Brahman at the same time and is distinct from Brahman. And that explains a lot. That explains how there can be an illusion, how there can be souls, how there can be a process that the souls have to take up in order to realize themselves. If we were absolutely one with Brahman or God without any distinction, then immediately you can't explain a lot of things. You can't explain why do we perceive so much distinction if there is no distinction whatsoever in Brahman. Then why is it that I'm seeing bodies? Why is it that I have these very distinct experiences? Some of them are very good, some of them are not very good. How is it that if I'm God, I have to take up a process to realize myself? Prabhupada would often frown upon, you know, he would often say, Krishna was God from the very beginning. He would speak this to even newcomers, which is quite extraordinary. He would say things like, from the very beginning of his birth, he would say things like, from the very beginning of his birth, he was killing Putanan demon. He married 16,000. From the very beginning, he exhibited his godly opulences. He didn't have to take up a process of meditation to realize that he was God. So if we are actually God without any distinction whatsoever, you can't explain why a person has to take up a process. You can't explain why there's so much variety. There are various ways they try to explain it. And many students, they like these ideas. They play around with them a lot. We're one with God. We are God. But the world we see is simply a reflection of a false reflection of ourselves. And they think this is a very excellent explanation of the variety. But it doesn't explain a lot of things, because if God is all-pervading, how does he reflect? And what is a reflecting surface? If God doesn't have any attributes without distinction, then how does he reflect a world full of distinction and attributes? How do you explain that? And so in many ways, and why is it that if we're God without distinction that we have to take up a process? If God is the absolute truth, how can he be subject to anything false? You know, how can he be limited by material concepts if he's all-pervading? In this way, immediately you can't explain so many things if you say that we're one with God without distinction. And then it becomes dissatisfying. Immediately, if we're one without distinction, then everything we're doing in this material world is simply arbitrary. This is why Mayavad is considered similar to atheism. Because, an example, we had a pretty young couple come here about 2 weeks ago. Very nice. They had just had a newborn child. And the child, you know, the guy was like, he was totally infatuated with the kid, you know. So although we had like a little discussion downstairs on Sunday for the newcomers, he was really more absorbed in the kid. And he was also hearing a little bit, but he was just infatuated with his newborn child. And his wife was there also. They were both very favorable. And so they had an idea of non-duality in terms of non-distinction. This is a popular notion. At least people think that they like this idea. I don't think they really do, but they think that they do. So you have this idea that we're one without distinction. So immediately the question can be asked, if that is the case, then you've just reduced your relationship with your child to something very arbitrary and illusory and useless. Because if you were to actually realize your non-distinction with your child, what would be the necessity of maintaining the relationship? It's all an illusion. Just like if you see a mirage in the desert, as long as you are an illusion, you chase after the mirage. But once you understand that it's a mirage, even if you continue to see it, you don't walk after it, presumably, unless you're dumb, you know, or psychotic or something, isn't it? I had this experience, I've shared this many times before, when I went to the Burning Man. And the Burning Man is a sense gratification retreat. it's popular, and many people there are kind of spiritual and kind of like this whole idea of like freedom from Babylon, you know, this kind of mood. So it's in the middle of the desert of Nevada, so there's no water anywhere. So people have to actually bring in trucks of water, you know, for doing all the bathroom program and everything like that. You can imagine some people are there for like a month plus, so you can imagine how nasty it can get. Anyway. So I was there walking around the Burning Man campus one day when I was there with our devotee camp. And in the distance, I really could see that people were walking towards water. I could see it. It was like clear as anything. So I was like, oh, I didn't know they had a lake nearby. Because I actually thought it was there. So I actually started walking toward the mirage, you know, that I was seeing. And I was walking for about 20 minutes. And then I got a doubt. I'm like, maybe this is a mirage, because I had never had the experience of a mirage before. So I got the doubt that maybe it's a mirage. So I was kind of looking around me to see if anyone else was walking in that direction. And sure enough, no one was walking in that direction but me. So then I said, okay, maybe that's actually a mirage. So I stopped walking in direction. But when I turned around, I could still see it was there. I could still see people were walking toward it. It's not like it vanished all of a sudden. But now, because I've ascertained that it's a mirage, I stopped pursuing it. So similarly, if this world is just an illusion and we're really all one without distinction, then if you actually realize that all the relationships that you hold near and dear actually are arbitrary and illusory and foolish, and to maintain such a relationship will be like trying to maintain, is just like me walking towards a mirage after I figured out it's a mirage. It's actually foolish. So then, of course, if you were presented in these terms, because it strikes a personal chord, people wouldn't like it, but that's exactly what they're saying. And this is why sometimes Mayavad philosophy is equated to atheism. Because in the atheistic idea, also values of good and bad, the moral compass is very arbitrary. Because in the atheistic naturalistic worldview, everything is more or less an amalgamation of chemicals acting helplessly under the laws of physics. So with that type of notion, the moral compass is very arbitrary. It's just whatever you think is good and bad. Out of a naturalistic concept, where you have an idea that the world is just an amalgamation of chemicals acting helplessly under physical laws, then you can't objectively speak about morality. It's just like your opinion. Someone says this is good, and someone else says killing is bad, and someone else says killing is good. And what's the naturalistic objectivity on that point? So when you're dealing with things like moral compass or values, and so it becomes simply arbitrary in such a worldview. And so also in the Mayavada idea, where we're all one without distinction, then good and bad is simply arbitrary and illusory. And this way, you have a worldview that's not tenable on a practical level. And therefore, vimuktamaninas, this verse comes up, is simply illusory. Vimuktamaninas is simply an imagination. Because on a practical level, it's not tenable. And it also, so it's not true on a practical level, and also shastrically speaking, with such an idea, you can't explain so many things, like the idea of love, which Krishna speaks about all the time in Bhagavad Gita, particularly. He mentions, what is that? Bahavo jnana tapasa putama bhava magata iti mato abhajante mam buddha bhava samanvita sa sarvavit bhajati. Many places, mam mana bhava, mam bhakto, mam yajimam namaskuru. Krishna speaks about, what is that other verse from chapter 212? Not tweham. Okay, you know. Never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these beings, and so on. So Krishna speaks a lot about distinction. He speaks about devotion to himself. He speaks about the ability of devotion to get one beyond the material illusion, and so on. So if someone has a concept that we're all one without distinction, how do you explain all these concepts that come in Shastra? Rasa vaisa, rasam hevayam, ladu anandi bhavati. Krishna is rasa. And when a living entity attains rasa, he experiences ineffable bliss. How do you explain that with a concept of Brahman without distinction of any sort? And in this way, the only way you could explain it is by saying that the Shastras speak in a esoteric way, parokshavad. This is what usually is, how you say, invoked. When all these types of very straightforward statements of the Shastras come up, they say you have to understand it in a secondary way. Because our understanding of what Brahman is doesn't match with what's saying in the Shastra. So you have to understand the Shastra in a secondary sense. But in Shastra hermeneutics, that's not the way of understanding. Lord Chaitanya argues this when he's speaking to the Mayavadis and Benares. He says, Shastra is supposed, the direct state meaning of Shastra is supposed to be accepted. Otherwise, you can make Shastra to be whatever you want it to be. If you never have to accept the direct statements, I've often given the example. Just like Krishna says, mam mana bhava mam bhakto mam yajimam namaskuru. You know, become my devotee, worship me, always think of me. And then the commentary says it is known unto Krishna. So, well, why is the Krishna said? Well, you have to understand it in a secondary sense. So then whose secondary sense do I understand? Do I understand yours or do I understand his? Because in a secondary sense, anyone can say anything. I've often given an example. It's just like if we're in the prasadam line and I'm standing in front of the puris. Now everyone knows what a puri is, right? You know, it's like a little flatbread thing that we like to eat sabjis with and so on. So I'm standing in front of the puris and I say, I would like two puris. Now if the person serving understands that statement in a secondary sense, then immediately it becomes incomprehensible. The situation becomes bewildered. If he says, well, what you really mean is you want to go to Jagannath Puri. No, I want two puris, you know, these little flatbread things. No, what you really mean, as soon as you say what you really mean, then whatever you say after that is going to be incomprehensible. It makes the situation completely bewildered. So similarly, when you take very straightforward statements of Shastra and understand them in a secondary way, they immediately become bewildered understandings. The Shastra immediately becomes incomprehensible, and it becomes arbitrary, because anyone can say whatever they want after that. If you never have to accept the direct meaning, anyone can say anything they want after that. I remember this is the reason why I loved English class. I often mention this too. In English class, you could speculate whatever you wanted, because you never knew what the person was actually talking about, you know? Especially reading Shakespeare or these like poetic literatures. We would read them, and in English class, you had to come into the class giving like a perspective of what it was all about. So I never used to do any reading because I hated reading. I hated school. You know, school was a very useless thing for me. You know, so I didn't like reading, but I would read just like a paragraph before the class. You know, during the passing period, we had about a 5-minute passing period. So in between, I would read a paragraph. And you know, I'm a talker. So when class got started, I would just start speculating like anything. This means this. This means that. And the English teacher would be very good, you know, congratulate me. And all my friends knew, they were like hard workers, they would study, they would really think about these things in a more substantial way. And they knew that I wouldn't study, you know, because I used to cheat off of their papers all the time for the homework and so on. So they knew I didn't study. So when a teacher would congratulate me for my profound insights on the chapter, my friends would be very agitated, you know, with the teacher. She doesn't know anything and so on. And this is my junior year I'm thinking of particularly. And I remember we have four-quarter system. The very first quarter, I got the highest grade in the class. And all my friends were furious, you know, because I got it simply by speculating. I never did much of the homework, and somehow I passed the test and so on. So when you're reading like a literature, when you don't ask the author what is his actual meaning, you can make it out to mean whatever you want. But certainly the author must have had a reason for writing that book. Although you may take it in a secondary poetic sense for your own appreciation and so on. But the author actually had a reason for which he actually composed the literature. And if you really want to know what the reason is, you have to inquire from him. So similarly, so this idea of that everything is Brahman, this is the idea that's been expressed in this verse. This is speaking about different types of species born from perspiration, born from seeds, born from eggs, born from the womb, the senses, outer space. The variety of things we see in the material world is actually all Brahman. It's just one substance. It's Brahman. But it's Brahman in the sense of being non-separate. And within Brahman, you have potency. And so the variety we see in this world is a manifestation of the potency of Brahman. So just as Brahman is real, so also his potency is real. That's the first line of the purport. Prabhupada says, we do not accept the idea of Brahma Satyam Jagan Mithya, that Brahman is real and everything else is false. We don't accept that. Because just as Brahman is real, his potency is real. And the experiences that we get due to the influence of the potency is also real. Although one experience is insubstantial and one experience is substantial. So in other words, one type of potency of Brahman is the soul. And another type of potency is the Maya Shakti. So the Maya Shakti is real. The Maya Shakti is really influencing us. And the experiences that we get from the Maya Shakti are real experiences. We actually do experience that. But the experience is insubstantial. Just like the experience in a dream. When you have an experience in a dream, the experience is actually real. You have a real experience. And sometimes we know we have a real experience when we wake up from a certain nightmare, or if you wake up from a lusty dream or something. And you can still feel the effects of the dream. So the experience is actually very real, although it's insubstantial. So Maya, one potency of Brahman is Jiva, another poem says Maya. Maya is actually influencing us. The experiences we have in the material world are actually real, but they're insubstantial. And then through the process of bhakti, you can attract the influence of another type of potency of Brahman called the Swarup Shakti. And when you get the influence of that potency, those experiences are also real. The Swarup Shakti reveals the spiritual reality. It reveals Krishna and all the glory of his Namrup Gunalila. And when you're experiencing that, it's actually real. Everything is real. There is no falsity in Brahman. But one reality is insubstantial by the arrangement of Krishna's potency, and another reality is substantial. In this way, we are non-dualists, and our understanding of disharmony is due to a sense of separateness. I'm separate from you. One group is separate from another group. One group is, completely distinct from another group. This leads to animosity in the material world. So people like the idea of oneness because of this. And oneness, we can be freed of the animosity that comes due to the sense of distinction or separateness. But in our idea, that is also possible. Yes, there's oneness when we all become one in idea of service to God. Just like a nation can become one on a patriotic level. Although there's so many persons in one nation, they all have their individuality. But when, we're going to war, everyone tends to become one in terms of purpose. And they share oneness with one another. Or another good example is our ashram, perhaps. In our ashram, we have so many variety of living entities that it's a somewhat mind-boggling, And if people wanted to see how Krishna consciousness works, then they can come to the ashram, and see, Obviously, many of us wouldn't have anything to do with one another aside from the principle of Krishna. And even within the principle of Krishna, we have trouble dealing with one another sometimes or most of the time. But we are able to overcome those obstacles to whatever degree, however feeble or strong, because of the principle of Krishna consciousness that causes us to seek a higher level of consciousness and so on. So in this way, we have a philosophy that's practically tenable and shastrically correct and beautiful. And this is what we're non-dualists in a profound sense of the term. So that's my discussion. Anyone want to say anything? Ask anything? I described everything. Is that good?
Very nice class. And regarding towards Brahma, Satya Jagat Mithya, Srila Prabhupada gave a very nice example, that a tax collector, when tax collector collects the tax, property tax, for example, then he gave example, we have to burn the house. So that is not the solution. Suppose to evade, that the property tax, one cannot burn the house. That is a nice example he gave. And like in connection to that, the body is immaterial, that doesn't mean we can murder it. That he gave in purport. Yeah. So that's that. And
you got the example? Yeah. Because the government is taking property tax, and you don't like that, you can't burn the house. And so I'll be free from this property tax. That was from the purport. Srila Prabhupada said, just because the body is temporary, doesn't mean you can kill it, and no one will accept such an idea like that. So although there are temporary realities, they are real, and you have to really acknowledge them. And if you don't, you're going to really suffer the consequences in the form of karma. And on a smaller level, the police or something like that. Yeah.
So you were talking about you have to take the statements of Shastras directly and with their direct meaning, not see the secondary meaning or something like that. So
yes, unless paradoxical statements, such as a statement in the Ishopanishad where Krishna says, "You walk and he walks and he doesn't walk. He's very far." These are obviously, they're not contradictions; they're paradoxical. Paradoxes are meant to help you slow down and think. Our tendency is to go zoom, 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 zoom. So the shastra will throw a paradox at you, so it'll make you stop and think. And that way you can try to understand what is the... So in those situations, interpretation is required. It has to be understood in a secondary sense. But otherwise, other simple statements like surrender unto me, that's pretty clear. Although we may not like it and therefore are inclined to understand it in a secondary sense, but it's clear, Krishna says surrender to him.
I was thinking about not exactly contradictory statements, but sometimes when Prabhupada translates something, many times you hear also the Prabhupada is given the bhakti translation, or kind of his translation. So the word-to-word meanings will say something, and sometimes the translation will be slightly different. So how do we understand that?
Yeah, this irritates a lot of people who read our Bhagavad Gita, that Krishna is talking about, you know, karma yoga, and Prabhupada said devotion to the Supreme. And then the next chapter, he's talking about jnana, and he says devotion to the Supreme. And then he's talking about yoga, devotion to the Supreme, and people get really irritated when they read. No, especially amongst Hindus, particularly. Because Americans, they don't even know anything. This is our advantage. But the Hindus who think they know a little bit something, we know Sanskrit, we know Hindi. And they said, this translation obviously isn't what it says, you know, and Prabhupada is just saying. That is easily reconciled by the understanding that Krishna is systematically building up to a conclusion. And so he's not just presenting knowledge in an isolated way. When Prabhupada is giving his understanding, it's a synthesis based on the actual Siddhanta that Krishna is trying to bring us to progressively. So Krishna speaks about a whole process of yoga, for example, that ultimately brings us to the point of bhakti, devotion to himself, on which he says, in my opinion, this is the best one. So his heart is to bring us to that conclusion. So when a person is speaking, he has his, let's say, there's the head and the heart. So there's an intellectual presentation, and then there's the heart behind it by which he's making the presentation. So Krishna's giving a very intellectual, systematic presentation, and his heart is to bring us to the point of devotion to himself, by which we can become satisfied, and he also becomes happy by that. So then, when you look at the Bhagavad Gita only from the intellectual perspective, the academic perspective, without understanding the heart of the presenter, then, yes, you find Prabhupada's translations dissatisfying, because it's not sticking to just the strict academic format. But when you, in other words, it's the tendency to separate the person from what he's speaking. And when one does that, you don't get a very clear understanding of actually what's being discussed. Like I think one time, I forget where it's at, somewhere in Mumbai or something, I've mentioned this before, Prabhupada went to like a Gita camp or something. And they have verses of Bhagavad Gita all over this pandal, big, huge pandal program. But there was no picture of Krishna anywhere. So Prabhupada took issue with that. So he went to the founders and he said, where is Krishna? There's no picture of Krishna. And the person said, we are not interested in Krishna. We are only interested in what Krishna says. Like that. And he was like, what type of... So Prabhupada said, you're a rascal. You know, because you can't take the message without the heart of the message, the person's heart. Why is he presenting that? There's a reason for saying that. And so when you understand the reason behind Bhagavad Gita, at least as Gaudiya Vaishnavas, our conclusive understanding of Krishna speaking Bhagavad Gita is bhakti. And we reason well for that through using Bhagavad Gita itself and other corollary shastras. So his heart is bhakti, and that's what Krishna's trying to actually bring us to. Now, because people don't understand that, when they read Bhagavad Gita, that the tendency is to take whatever you like, because you're not considering the person behind the message. So I like this aspect, I like that aspect. I remember going to one yoga website and someone said the essence of Bhagavad Gita is meditation on the chakra system. You know, and they quoted some obscure verse from chapter 6 Bhagavad Gita that had nothing to do with anything conclusive in the message of Gita and so on. In fact, in that very chapter, Krishna says, I think this one is the best. Bhakti, they didn't quote that one though. And so in this way, when you take a message without the person, the tendency is just to take what you like. You know, and in that way we can always argue what is the actual message. But once you inject the person into the picture, it is very hard, it's much harder to do that. So in Prabhupada's translations, he's preventing us, however much it is to our dismay, but he's preventing us from getting bewildered about what the actual heart of Krishna is in his presenting the Bhagavad Gita. His actual heart is to bring us to the point of bhakti. And so every purport proper will remind us of that conclusion. And we won't know that it's a conclusion so much until we come to the end of the Bhagavad Gita. Oh, this is actually what Krishna's trying to say. So for persons who think that they have the ability to read Shastra without the help of the Acharyas who know the heart of God, then shame on them. Then they will always be bewildered, and they'll always be arguing about what is the actual conclusion. But if you take the heart of God, which is known by the Acharyas, as Krishna says to Devas Muni, the devotees are my heart, and I am the heart of devotees. They know no one but me, I know no one but them. So they know the heart of God. So then their presentation of what God is trying to say is what, you know, humble persons will accept as the conclusion. And it is also the recommended path of understanding. Mahajano Yena Katasa Panta. What is that? Adhusar? Tarko Pratishta Shrutayo Vibhina. That the absolute truth is not understood by tarka, you know, argument. Or Shrutayo Vibhina, quoting Shastra. It is not understood by quoting Shastra even. Dharmasya Tattvam Nihitam Guhayam. The actual truth of Dharma is in the heart of self-realized persons, therefore one should follow them. They're the path that they mark out. Mahajana Yena Katasa Panta. Generally, people tend to accept Mahajans according to if they speak things that agree with their own way of thinking already. They think that is true. If a spiritual master speaks something that which is in accord with my own way of thinking already, then he is speaking truth. So they actually don't accept the Acharya, but they accept themselves. And that kind of goes on in the beginning of spiritual life. We're hearing anything that isn't in accord with my particular predilection in terms of philosophy, in terms of taste in Krishna consciousness. Yata karma yata ruchi. When Uddhava asks the question, why is there so many variety of religions? Krishna basically says, he gives this statement, yata karma yata ruchi. People come up, they come to conclusions of understandings according to their activities and according to their taste. And therefore you see so much variety. And Krishna makes that point. They don't accept the person. And what is his actual conclusion? So if we're smart, we accept Acharyas. And they're presenting the heart of God as such. Even amongst that, then, so many Acharyas, they say so many different things and so on. And therefore the injunction to accept one Acharya in the beginning. And that way move on from there.
Yeah. Hare Krishna. Thank you for your class. On this topic of non-dualism with distinction and without distinction, I'm wondering, do you think that the reason why people accept non-dualism without distinction because they're afraid of giving themselves? Because in the other path, in bhakti, naturally one knows I have to give myself to...
Sure, definitely. As Prabhupada said, Vidaragabhaya Krodha, Mamaya Mama Pashita, in that purport, Bahavo Nana Tapasaputna Ma Bhava Magata. Krishna says one has to give up attachment, fear, and anger. That's one thing you have to do. And the other thing is Bahavo Nana Tapasa. You have to perform the austerity of gaining knowledge in order to develop love for Krishna. So Prabhupada describes there, number one, people are attached. And number two, bhaya, they're afraid. They're afraid of being persons, Prabhupada says. That's how he translates it there. Because the experience of personhood in the material world is very unpalatable, full of heartbreak, full of complications, full of animosity. So therefore, when we hear that there's an absolute truth that's personal, we project onto the spiritual personal reality and think it's more of the same of what we're experiencing in the material world. And so the idea of non-distinction, oneness without distinction, seems so much more peaceful and wonderful and palatable. And then the other reason is krodha. People are angry with the hypocrisy that they've experienced in traditions where the surrender to God is stressed and I'm the representative of God and therefore you have to surrender to me and dedicate everything to me, as our shastras also say. And then those gurus have been shown to be fraudulent in so many ways, farcical and whimsical. And people seeing countless examples of that, especially in the age of Kali, again and again and again and again and again and again and again, they become angry when these ideas are presented. And so why do I need an intermediary between myself and God? I'm also one with God, and I therefore I can know God without any help. I don't need an intermediary. So that it's stemming from frustration with these ideas misapplied on the material in the material world. Fear of being a person, and also Bahavog Nanatapasa, people aren't knowledgeable. Generally we're guided by emotion than knowledge. That's the statement where Prabhupada says, religion without philosophy is sentimental, and philosophy without religion is mental speculation. So especially in religious groups, you tend to get more of the sentimental type most of the time, because people aren't interested in philosophy. You know, they make claims to that's not for me, or I like simple presentations, or they make these types of claims and are less interested in understanding the philosophy, at least by hearing thoroughly about the truth. You know, we like the process of hearing, but hardly anyone hears systematically. So they, you hear from here, you hear from there, and it's like really fun. You get inspired, but hardly anyone's educated with the actual philosophies involved. And then someone comes along who's actually more well-read, more thoughtful in a philosophical sense with some of these topics, and they present bewildering things to these sentimentalists. And then the sentimentalists become very upset because it shakes the ground of their faith. You know, certain topics which are very subtle and require more deep level of thought, and so someone has done that, and the sentimentalist hasn't done that. So here comes the philosopher, I'm a devotional philosopher, and he shakes the ground of their faith, and they don't like that because they're sentimental. You know, they haven't done the austerity of gaining knowledge, either by study or by hearing, at least by hearing, and that too, hearing systematically, you know, so that you can actually begin to assimilate some of the messages. You know, of course, you know, these things are hard to regulate because we're all individuals, we all have the inner quest is different for all of us. Some of us are very serious about it. Some of us are not so serious about it. So you can't really regulate that. And therefore, these are the certain, let's say, limitations of, let's say, an institutional application. You can't really force people to be Krishna conscious. You know, it's really a personal choice. And you can only try to create an atmosphere that is conducive for moving in the right direction. But you can't force people. Some people, they're happy to remain sentimental. They don't want to know the philosophy, and they think that's perfectly okay. And therefore they experience these anarthas in the form of illusion about philosophy, about the actual Siddhantic understanding of things. This is a type of anartha that prevents us from chanting purely. According to Bhaktivinoda Thakur, there are four categories of anarthas. And one of them is Tattva Brahma, illusion about philosophy. And this happens because of not hearing systematically and or in study, like this. And that way, people, especially people outside, they're usually not that philosophical. Like I said, when you explain to them, for example, I was talking to my friend Varun here in the evening time one time, and I was mentioning about the scientific stance on worldview, about it basically being an amalgamation of chemicals acting helplessly under the laws of physics. And therefore, you have no free will. So no one can take responsibility for any wrongdoings. He said, no, you still have free will. I was like, obviously, you've not thought about this very deeply. No, you still have free will. Even though everything is just chemicals acting helplessly under the laws of physics, there's still free will. So that I was like, okay, you're not a philosopher, obviously, And he said, no, I'm not. But, so then it means that a lot of these things are very subtle. And people, in other words, they think that they're accepting a conclusion without actually really knowing what it is that they're accepting. I think that with this idea of Brahman without different and non-different, I think people actually have that way of thinking about the topic, actually. It's not that we're one without distinction, but we're one and distinct. I think that's the way they really think about it. But the way it's been articulated to them and the way they think they understand it is oneness without distinction. But then when you point up all these things, they don't tend to like it. I thought like that also. I remember when I first came, I was reading the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. And somehow from that book, I got the idea I was God. I don't know how. I don't even remember what the book is about now. But I got the idea that I was God. But the way I thought of it in my mind, to be honest with you, I really thought because I'm a part of God, I'm God. which is kind of our philosophy also, part and parcel, you know. But I thought, so I'm part of God, therefore I'm also God. And I shared this story with you many times. When I went downstairs to have dinner with my mother and we went to say prayer, I didn't want to say prayer because I'm like, I'm God. I don't have to pray to my, praying to myself would be absurd, you know, it'd be ridiculous. So why would I pray? And so I wasn't praying. She said, why aren't you praying? And, you know, I didn't want to tell her because I was a little afraid. And I didn't know about Christian Leela all the time. You know, I couldn't give the answer. This is my Leela. So God is afraid. And so finally I tell her, well, I said, you know, I'm God. Don't worry, you're also God, but you just haven't realized it yet, you know. And she looked at me real heavy, and she said, if you don't sit down and pray, you know. I had to sit down and pray. And at that time, I realized maybe I'm not God, you know. If I'm scared of my skinny mother, you know, then I had a doubt if I was God or not. Later on, I came to read Science of Civilization, and probably said using language part and parcel, you know, so you're God and distinct from God. Then I was like, that's what I was actually thinking in my mind. But the way it was articulated to me and then subsequent misconception I got was, you know, I'm God. But once you hear it properly explained, you know, and the kind of subtler reality, then you say, oh, that's actually what I was conceiving of. So I think people do conceive of it more like a Christian conscious perspective of oneness. But the way it's been articulated to them, and because they generally tend to be sentimental, they gain a misconception from it like that. So these points, Vaya, Krodha, and lack of knowledge. Okay.
To understand that the point between which you mentioned about how the impersonalists, they take they try to understand the scriptures in a secondary meaning, so they do accept some of the
direct
some things like tattvamasi or something, and they take that as the main essence, and then in light of that they try to understand everything else.
Yeah.
And what we are trying to do is we take the more important things in, so as to say, the Bhagavad Gita and Bhagavatam, and then in light of that understand the other scriptures, like whatever the Vedas say or Upanishads say. And
sure.
So is that the right understanding?
Yeah, that can be understood in that way. But of course, our acharyas also reason for personalism using the Upanishads and so on as well. Because in the Upanishads, there are statements that are very personal, that speak of a distinct absolute reality, you know, the super soul, the soul turning towards the super soul. These are there are many such statements in the Shastras. So even if you say they take those, in fact, those statements like aham brahmasmi, tattvamasi, they don't understand in the proper way also, at least as far as Gaudiya acharyas are concerned. And with their understanding of that, how do you reconcile that understanding with the other very personal statements that do come in the Shastras, which speaks about absolute having form and so on. And so then they take it in another sense like that. Of course, these things will go on eternally. You know, Krishna, there's a nice verse in the sixth canto of Bhagavatam that mentions how all glories to the personality of Godhead with unlimited qualities. He causes, by his qualities, he causes the soul to forget his actual self, and therefore begin argument, sometimes agreeing, sometimes disagreeing. And this way, they come up and with different philosophies and arguments, and Krishna creates a situation in this world where no one is able to come to any conclusion. You know, there's a nice verse like that. I have to learn this verse because I do like this verse. He creates a situation in the world where no one can come to any conclusion. So using the Shastras, anyone, that's where it says, Shrutayo Vibhina. Even by quoting Shastra, you're not coming to a conclusive understanding. It'll always be argue city, you know. So yeah, like that.
Like, so can we say that, understanding this, that, so it's not that these scriptures are, so the we accept bhakti scriptures as our main scriptures, and then in light of that we understand other scriptures.
I wouldn't express it like that, because like I said, our acharyas do reason for bhakti using the Upanishadic literatures or the Shruti as well. If you want to go into an in-depth understanding of this, you can look at the Tattva Sandarbha. I think our BBT just published the first volume of six, they published a Tattva Sandarbha. And there, Jiva Goswami argues why we accept the Bhagavatam as our highest pramana. You know, in the beginning, he covers a materialistic perspective in one verse. He says, we have four defects, so whatever we know is insubstantial. Finish that, close that chapter. So we have to accept the Vedas. And then he argues that we only have 6% of the actual Vedic canon available to us. And that was during Jiva Goswami's time. So we can imagine it's even less now. So he said, in order to get the full scope of Vedic thought, you're not going to be able to get it exactly from the Shruti. So then he argues that this is the reason for the Puranas and the Itihasas and the Mahabharata. So he argued and that they're just as good as the Shruti. And he gets very, very shlokas. He uses the Upanishads also to corroborate his point. And then in this way, he works up to the Bhagavatam. And in the Bhagavatam, he says, the crucial factor in the presentation of Tattva Sandarbha is the position of Vyasadeva, who's the compiler of the Vedanta literatures. So this is like a pivotal element of his Tattva Sandarbha presentation. He spends many verses showing the pivotal position of Vyasadeva. And then he talks about Vyasadeva's samadhi in the beginning of the Bhagavatam. And then what was his conclusion after his absorption in samadhi? And his conclusion is a course bhakti, a devotional one. And that way, this has to be the topmost understanding, because he who is the compiler of the Vedic canon, from his samadhi, this understanding is coming. In other words, devotion to God is the samadhi bhashya of Vyasadeva, the compiler of the Vedic literatures. That's why in the second verse of the Bhagavatam, we say that the Bhagavatam was compiled after his mature realization. I think that language is used by Prabhupada, right? In other words, mature realization means here his samadhi. After going into samadhi, this Bhagavatam is his samadhi bhashya. It's the presentation of his absorption. And that presentation is a devotional one. And therefore, the Bhagavatam is the highest pramana. This way, Jiva Goswami makes his arguments. So I wouldn't understand it in the first way, that we're taking the bhakti literatures as to make them distinct from these other literatures which the Mayavadis or impersonals like to use. We take all the literatures, and the Acharyas reason well for bhakti using the Upanishadic literatures as well. So that's how I understand.
Thank you. Can I ask one?
Okay.
You mentioned about there was some discussion about accepting whatever we hear from Guru. And then we also hear the idea that we should be independently thoughtful.
Yeah.
So I'm sure there is no contradiction, but yeah, it appears to be that you have to be independently thoughtful as well as you have to completely just without doubt accept what the words of Guru.
Well, that would be ideal, you know, without doubt. But the actual reality is that inquiry is part of the relationship with Guru. Pranipatena pariprashtena sevaya. So questions is a very integral part of the relationship with Guru. In fact, if you cannot put any questions forth to the Guru, then we question how substantial such a relationship actually is. Because inquiry is one of the essential elements of the relationship with the Guru. In fact, he's manifested because we have so many questions. You know, questions and answers is the first chapter of Bhagavatam. The reason for his manifestation is because the super soul, we're not able to hear the answers that the super soul is giving. So we need an external representative to present the answers to us. So pariprashna is, so it's not like accept the Guru without doubt, but you have some doubt, you don't say anything. Arjuna, throughout the Bhagavad Gita, is presenting his doubts very frankly, and so his doubts are removed by the strong presentation of Krishna. So also is our relationship with the Guru. There should be questions. Jignasu Shaya Uttamam. In the beginning, the questions tend to be about the body and mind. Should I get married? Should I not get married? Who should I marry? Should I marry one who's within this con? Is it okay if I marry someone outside of this con? This is obviously not Shreya Uttamam, Jignasu Shreya Uttamam, but at least it's the start of the relationship with the Guru. You have some confidence in him in that way. And as you get more purified, you start to want to know more things about how to develop your inner life more. You know, and some of the esoteric aspects of Krishna consciousness become important for you all of a sudden through purification. And that time you will have questions, you need guidance. So although we do accept everything the Guru is, we accept that whatever Guru is speaking to us is the delegation of Krishna coming through him. That's the way we view it. But then we have questions. We don't understand things. We have doubts. So inquiry has to go on. In fact, if there are no questions, the spiritual master will probably be terribly concerned. You know, really concerned. Like sometimes, you know, these big seminars we have, and, you know, Maharajas would be there. Are there any questions? And everyone's just like, now, you know damn well everyone didn't understand everything, you know. And still, no one has any questions. That's amazing. No one, and if you talk to them after the class, they cannot present to you the points that were made in the class in a very comprehensible way, and yet they had no questions. So if you have no questions, the spiritual master would be extremely concerned. Are these people getting anything? Are they understanding anything? In fact, in Rupa Goswami's Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Nectar Devotion, the first thing is to take shelter of the spiritual master. The second thing is to get initiated. And then the third thing is to inquire. Inquiry is happening after initiation. Usually we have questions up to the point of initiation. And then we think, okay, I got it now. I'm initiated. I got everything. I know everything. But real inquiry starts when real inquiry, that means, you know, inquiry of sat, jivasa, tattva, jignasa, that happens after you become more mature. So it's an internal process, questioning. Not questioning guru, but putting forth questions to the guru. That is required. Okay, your last statement.
Hare Krishna, Prabhu. I was wondering, you mentioned this example of the couple with the infant child, and how if we're actually non-dual without distinction, then it kind of kills relationships and everything like that. I was wondering, someone might counter, you know, maybe not from this particular example with having the child and everything, but say like a single male college student, female, I guess. They might say, well, yeah, relationships, you know, if you need to like feel that comfort of the relationships, then that's fine. But actually the higher reality is to realize you're completely dependent, and like that's like the real position
you're
of strength.
You're completely independent.
The real position of strength. Yeah, you don't need anyone else. So like relationships also, you know, they're illusory, but like if you really need to feel that comfort, you know, then...
Yeah. Like the only problem with that type of argument, that is factually what the Gyan Marg is all about. You know, it's just this... detachment to the extreme, and by which they become averse to material existence and everything in it, including relationships. So that is a viable process, by the way. In other words, you can offer your opinion as much as you want. They say opinions are like, anyway, I can't say that in the Bhagavatam class. There's a saying, though, many of you may be familiar with it just by me. Yeah, so that understanding isn't in accord with the Shastra. That we're completely independent. And on a practical level, how do you prove that you're completely independent? I would like to ask you a question. Do you eat, for example? Where do you get your food from? You know, are you following the laws of the state? You know, are you doing absolutely, just like our friend, what was his name, Gregory? At Northwestern. And he thought, I'm completely free, I can do whatever I want. And he vandalized some portion of Northwestern University and got caught. So they arrested him. This completely free person got arrested. And then he started saying how he's above the material nature and all these things like that. So it sounded weird to the police, so they took him to the psychiatric ward and they locked him up for about a week. And on the eighth day, after he in the psychiatric ward, he was still talking about how he's free, he's above the material nature. You know, tree beer, guru mayur, bhava, or like this, you know. Like Krishna, so they were keeping him locked up. Finally, on the eighth day, he got scared. They're not going to release me. So then he had to, you know, supplicate to the, you know, I'm normal. He started acting normally and so on. They released him. He came to the temple that Sunday thereafter and told us what took place. So I was like, where's your freedom? So not only is it not, this idea of being completely independent isn't in accord with Shastras. You practically can't say that. Now, for those yogis who are existing in the Himalayan mountains, like literally surviving on air and so on, they can more closely say like that and then to be not hypocritical. But the thing that's self-contradictory about that is that if you're independent, why do you follow a process? See, God doesn't have to follow any process because he's independent. And when you're dependent, you have to follow something in order to come to a stage. So that means you're dependent on the process for realization. So it's not in accord with practical reality. Although the yogis in the mountains, which I'm sure we can hardly find few these days, will come close to convincing us that such a reality is true. That's what I would say for someone who wanted to understand intellectually. Okay, you know, it's 8:31, and I don't know if you want to make a note, or is it, you want to ask something?
What this conversation brought to my mind and what you're teaching about was about our personality and how a personality is kind of like wrapping up all that distinction, you know. And I've always wondered, you know, do we have any idea why God created us, particularly, you know, with our own individuality?
Yeah, in short, we're not created. So Krishna says that in Bhagavad Gita, never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings. So we're not created. This word creation is just to express the idea of a subordinate position to God. But it's not to say that we didn't exist at one point and then he created us. We've always existed. And why do we exist? We exist to love, actually. That's the purpose of our existence. We exist to love and ultimately to love Krishna. That's the actual purpose of existence, to exchange relationship with the Supreme Lord. So that's what our shastras tell us, that we've always exist and we actually exist to love. In the material world, love is reflected and perverted and becomes self-centered selfishness or self-extended selfishness, and therefore we suffer. But if we can turn our face back towards God, then the real purpose of our existence comes to the forefront, and that thing that comes to the forefront is love of God. So that's why we exist. Okay, thank you all very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.